Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
So, girl, just had enough, and I'm waiting here at the altar for that holy water.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Ashley McBride? Y'all like Ashley? Originally from Mammoth Springs, Arkansas, Nashville-based singer-songwriter Ashley McBride has opened for Beth Hart, Johnny Lee and the Urban Cowboys, and Point of Grace, just to name a few. She has hosted her own round at the prestigious Bluebird Cafe and can be seen playing around Nashville at the Commodore Grill and Cadillac Ranch. Ashley is currently playing regular shows in Arkansas, Kentucky, Mississippi, and Tennessee to promote her new album. She has CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at ashleymcbride.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark has opened shows for everyone from late blues legends Big Jack Johnson to Little Milton Campbell. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each show we feature an artist, and tonight's featured artist is Little Rock painter Doug Norton. And our featured piece is this painting here behind me entitled Vintage Hog, right here, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Doug at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Tonight, our stories are about our writers being under pressure and how they act and react. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Paul Strack's reaction to his family member's injury is, well, interesting. And we'll end the night with Catherine King being told to behave, but she finds herself in a sticky situation she must try to play off. But let's start the night with Holly Patton and a phone call that has her reaching for her knitting needles in Be Still My Heart.
I walk into my house with my three-year-old granddaughter, Addison. We've been in the lukewarm pool desperately trying to mitigate the heat and humidity of this oppressive July day in Arkansas. The cold air flowing from my air conditioner causes chill bumps to rise in my arms and legs. I hear the familiar chime of my new text message reminder. I'm simply trying to take 2 hours off on a Friday afternoon before returning to the incessant demands of ministry to play with my granddaughter. But I recognize my youngest sister's Colorado area code. Daddy failed his stress test. Has been having some chest pain. We'll have routine procedure on Monday in Durango. Just wanted y'all to know. Right there in black and white. Chest pain. My father's father died when he was only 43. Routine, instantly, my chill bumps worsen. My father, a physician and a recreational pilot, hikes 14,000 feet rugged mountains, bikes over steep, rough terrain, and skis like a pro every minute he can get in the Colorado winter. So for him to admit to some chest pain is big, really big. colossal big. Quickly, I turn on the TV, thanking Comcast out loud for the first time in my life, and I find a Dr. Seuss episode on TV for Addie. Aha, are you okay? This child senses emotions as accurately as the thermometer outside. I reach over and hug her small body and sniff the chlorine in her damp red hair. I'm good, sugar. Just watch the Cat in the Hat, as if the Cat in the Hat can solve this problem. I quickly open my laptop to search for airfares to Durango. I am not an alarmist. I do not hoard canned foods or water. But over the past 40 years, I have finally learned to listen to my instincts. Well, most of the time. At least when it comes to men, and I trust this inner voice saying, go. Go now. I call my brother. Oh, Holly, it's nothing. You know the old man's going to outlive all of us. Hell, he showed me up running 8 miles last week. Matt, I can't explain it, but I just need to come. He laughs his carefree laugh. It's your cash, sister. My sister, Marcy, a nurse practitioner, reassures me over and over again. Holly, it's just a routine test. You don't need to come. Marcy, you know there is not one damn routine thing about our crazy family. Nothing. I'm coming. So can you please pick me up at the airport tomorrow? She, too, laughed and said, yeah, that's perfect timing. You can help me get moved into my new house and help me get organized. I am not known for my organizational skills. My refrigerator, it's like a science experience gone mad, mold growing on everything. No problem, Marcy. I'll jump right on that one. I spend the rest of my day trying to be playful with Addison, getting someone to cover me at church to preach on Sunday, and packing. Well, actually, I just stuff a pair of jeans and running shoes and shorts and a fleece into a small backpack, and I head to the airport before the sun comes up the next day. Daddy wakes me up at 4:30 a.m. It's time to go to the torture chamber, Holly. I grab my knitting project. Yes, I am learning how to knit. And it has given my sons fits of laughter, seeing my attention deficit self turning skeins of yarn into a somewhat misshapen blob of threads, with the dream that one day it will morph into a beautiful scarf. My father has been a physician for the last 49 years, never once a patient. He is on the other side and does not like it one iota. His blue eyes flicker suspiciously as we enter the admissions area. This is foreign land for him. We wait, and we wait, and we wait some more. Then we are told by the over-friendly nurse there's an emergency coming in. It's just horrible. A 45-year-old woman has had a heart attack, but she's alive. The tension gets as thick as the magazines stacked in the sterile waiting room. They lead Daddy back and prep him. At least 6 IV tubes snake in and out of him. His heart doctor, who is handsome and looks at the same age and in the same fitness level as my father, assures all of us that this will be nothing. We wave goodbye, and tears clog up my throat and my eyes. All I can see is that paper blue hat above my father's piercing blue eyes. 30 minutes go by. That's good, we all say to each other. And finally, the door opens and Dr. C steps through. His green eyes match his green scrubs. Well, I have a surprise for you, he says, strolling into the cardiac care waiting room. Instantly, my heart and spirit perk up. Of course, surprise conjures up really happy thoughts for me. Surprise parties, surprise visits, surprise gifts. He has 99% blockage in 2 arteries and 80% in 2 other places. He needs surgery immediately, and I can't do it here. I've called for the helicopter to take him to Albuquerque. We're taking him out to the helipad now. The helicopter roars and spins its way up into the blue Colorado skies as stupid, empty words shout out of our mouths. It's going to be okay, Daddy. We love you. Have the flight of your life. I spend the first hour of the 4-hour drive to Albuquerque calling my other siblings scattered among states. and my father's brothers and sister to tell them of this surprise. "Are you sure, Holly? Johnny?" my lawyer uncle inquires. "That just can't be." I can feel his disbelief, but have to be short. There's no time to stop and admire the breathtaking scenery as we speed and swerve through curvy desert roads, small towns, Indian reservations, and eventually to I-25 that leads us to the Presbyterian Hospital where my father has been flown. My sister, Marcy, takes a Valium and drinks 3 beers. The Lord is faithful and merciful. God will never leave or forsake us. But other words keep sneaking in, especially two other little small words, "what if?" So I keep praying and pressing the accelerator. Pray and press for 4 straight hours. Finally, Albuquerque. A screech to a stop, and we run into the hospital. It's past 10 p.m. Daddy is hooked up to all sorts of tubes and wires and already impatient and griping about getting out of this blink, 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 blink place. He greets us, though. "Well, that was the first damn helicopter ride I've ever had. Just wish I'd been flying." "I'm sorry, but visiting hours are over," the nurse perks. I kiss his cold forehead and turn to go. "Marcy, look," I say as I grab her arm. "It's God." She looks at me as if I've lost my mind. I point to a poster on the wall. Merely 3 feet away from my atheist father's hospital bed, a picture of a majestic mountain with words from the prophet Ezekiel. "I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I will remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh." We sob hysterically. 48 surreal, agonizing hours elapse before they actually perform the highly complicated surgery. We all take turns being irritable, hysterical, and scared. And all the times, I keep knitting like a madwoman. By the end of the 3rd day, the surgery actually takes place. It is barbaric and miraculous. They actually stop his heart from beating while inserting new valves. When they wheel my father out of the recovery room, 32 lines are inserted into his body. He is pierced, cut, bruised, and bloodied. We all take turns reassuring him. "You look great." And then we walk around the corner and weep. That was almost 2 years ago. And yesterday, my phone rings. And when I see the 970 area code, my stomach does that twisty, gut-wrenchy thing. And I answer with a tentative, "Hello? Holly, it's your daddy. I'm flying into Arkansas tomorrow. Do you want to go run Pinnacle Mountain?" Apparently, God was true to the promise and gave him back a new heart of flesh. Oh, and my scarf? It may just win a new world's record for being the longest scarf in history. I have no idea how to stop knitting.
Holly Patton is an ordained minister, writer, mother to Rainey and Patton, and grandmother to Addie and Stella. She lives in Little Rock. Next, when things go south, Paul Strack never loses his cool, at least not on the surface, in Friday Night Lights Out.
The kickoff was short, and instead of being caught, it bounced and bounced. 2 opposing football players dove headfirst for the loose treasure, and the collision ensued, the dreaded helmet-to-helmet collision. When all the players rose and stood, except one, I knew. When the coaches rushed on the field and gathered around, I knew. When the crowd gasped in silence, I knew. And when my wife Lisa began to ask, "Who is it?" I knew. I knew it was our son, Matthew. But the lump in my throat somehow prevented me from answering or breathing. Terrified, I was laser focused on one thing, movement. "Move your legs, Matthew. Move your arms, move something." And as if on cue, my prayers were answered. I think, I think I saw both his legs bend and extend ever so slightly. Surely I didn't imagine that. My breathing then resumed. Lisa's breathing was quite different. First, there was a state of denial. That's not Matthew, is it? Then there was the rubbing of the temples, the rolling of the eyes, the near tears, then the flood of tears, all mixed with intermittent breathing. Her son lay motionless on the football field. The silenced crowd waited, and I tried to offer some weak attempts at comfort while fighting back tears, but we both stared blankly at the field. Now, there seemed to be no movement at all. Then a friend offered his binoculars. Come on, Matthew, get up, or just move again so I know. The binoculars only revealed a closer look at our motionless son. It became painfully obvious that this wasn't one of those walk it off and rub some dirt on it and you'll be fine injuries. I caught sight of our 14-year-old daughter, Amanda, running up the bleachers from the student section, and I only thought my wife was freaking. If the sight of Matthew on the field didn't crush me, the panic on her face certainly did. Poor kid, she's 2 years younger and adores her older brother. And her first set of stitches for a head wound came at the hand of her big brother while they were playing football. Indoors. So now I have one daughter in full-blown panic. My wife is on the verge of hysterics. Our youngest daughter, Anna, seems confused and not sure how to react. And the paramedics with a stretcher are approaching our motionless son. So naturally, I did what any good husband and dad would do. I stood up and left. And began walking toward the football field. As I set one foot on the field, my cell phone rang. How random, I thought. I didn't recognize the number, but answered it anyway. I imagine that made for a most awkward sight, the father of an injured player talking on his phone while casually strolling along to check on his son being examined by paramedics. Well, at least I don't text and drive. On the line was Catholic High School's head football coach. Mr. Strack, Matthew is doing fine. We're just taking precautionary measures. Yeah, I knew that. That's why I was so Mr. Joe Cool back in the stands. Wait, are my pants wet? Well, that call helped immensely. But now as I stood over Matthew, still lying motionless on his back, a strange mixture of fear and anxiety and reality still prevailed. The paramedics continued their work, sliding the immobilization board under Matthew, strapping his helmet to it while instructing him to remain still. Suddenly, my phone rang again. Good grief. This time it was our oldest son, Michael, calling from Jonesboro, about 2 hours away. Of course, I had to answer while standing on a football field, while son number two is being wheeled away on a stretcher. But let's be honest, that's why we have these devices, isn't it? To stop everything we're doing and respond immediately, right? Well, Dad, is Matthew okay? The concern in his voice was obvious. Okay, now I do have to choke back tears. Two questions immediately enter my frazzled mind. One, why is he calling instead of texting? He always texts. And two, how the heck did he know this already? He was in Jonesboro. Oh, the power of technology and social media. I later learned that one of his friends in attendance had already posted a photo of the situation. Anyway, I think I convinced Michael that Matthew was going to be fine. At this point, I relaxed slightly and began communicating to those who had absolutely no idea of Matthew's status. Naturally, I began with text messages to my wife. All good, just a precautionary move. In hindsight, I'm not sure what I was thinking. Why would my wife pull out her phone and respond to a text in the middle of hysteria? I should have called. I mean, after all, I had already answered 2 phone calls, but you must remember, we've been married for over 26 years, and like most spouses, we don't talk. Needless to say, she didn't immediately see that message. After the paramedics loaded Matthew into the awaiting ambulance and began running a myriad of tests, I felt quite helpless. Although I believed the real danger was over and my anxiety was easing, I still needed to be doing something productive. Sure, why didn't I think of it sooner? I must tweet. So as I sat beside the paramedic and he tended to my strapped down, still in full football gear, told not to move son, I spewed forth. Tweeting from the back of an ambulance, son took a shot to the head, responsive in answering questions. In hindsight, this probably wasn't one of my better social media moves. And so we began the short jaunt to the ER. At this point, all that is right and good with mobile devices and social media, and more importantly, humanity in general, came along for the ride as well. Due to all the on-field activity, the radio coverage, and my now infamous shot to the head tweet, the majority of those concerned had no idea of Matthew's condition. Most all of them thought, as I did only moments before, that a tragedy had occurred. In those few minutes on a bumpy ride in the back of an ambulance, the emails, the texts, the phone calls, the tweets came in rapid succession. It was like sweet baby Jesus wrapped up in 140 characters or less. Okay, well, not those words precisely, but all of them, every single one of them, expressed the same sentiments. Our thoughts and our prayers are with you. There are times when I despise our constant connectivity. Social media conversation can get downright ugly at times, too. So much vitriol, so many hurtful comments, and too often expressions of why my ex is better than your Y. It often seems anything but social. And as I frequently recall these comments, it brings back all the emotion. How can all these people, even those who have no idea who our son is, care? It was the beauty of humanity at its best. While we were in the ER, an odd array of teenagers, most of them girls, and a few anxious adults, all dressed from head to toe in purple and gold, assembled in the waiting room. That wasn't surprising, but I was totally unprepared for the reaction from Matthew's two closest friends. Coming straight from the locker room, they were both visibly shaken, and eyes were obviously red due to the recent high pollen count. Yeah, that's it, the pollen. Once again, that awesomely beautiful humanity in us all couldn't help but rear its big old head. But enough was enough. It was time to end all the tears, all the drama, all this narrative. Matthew had been injured, but he was going to be fine. So after all the tests had been completed, it was time for me to break up this pity party and spread the good news to the assembled masses. I quietly gathered the group close by and shedding my somber tone that seemed to be hanging around for days, when in fact it was only a couple of hours, I excitedly exclaimed for the entire ER to hear, "It's a boy!"
Paul Strack is a native Arkansan residing in Maumelle for the past 25 years. He and his wife have four children. Paul is president of Custom XM, a marketing services firm with its headquarters located here in Argenta. In our final story of the night, Catherine King is thrown for a loop, and she has to try to stay calm in Uncle Shep.
When that thing hit the hearth and skidded across the floor, it looked at me, it talked to me, it took my breath away, and I thought I might have wet my pants. In the summer of 1942, tuberculosis ran rampant in southern Arkansas. The county nurse came to our grade school and administered the TB patch test. My baby sister failed the test twice. Mother and Dad took this news calmly and decided if my sister had to go to the TB sanitarium in Boonville, that my mother would go with her. With both mother and sister gone, I decided I would be in charge. I knew I was up to the task because I had heard mother tell Essie Proctor that I was 5 going on 17. I knew my being in charge would make my father happy because I would not require all that hand washing that mother did, nor would I insist he shave every day. I would probably miss my sister, but I knew that when I was in charge, everything would be nifty. I might have a little trouble with Miss Lucy, the housekeeper, because I don't think she really liked children. She was not allowed to spank us, but she could give me a look that would make me start confessing. Well, at least my brother's sins. Due to my sister failing the patch test, Daddy decided that all 5 of us would go to the county seat for x-rays. When we got to the clinic, Mother made me sit on my hands because she didn't want me touching anything or picking my nose, or that's what she said. We all passed the x-rays, even my sister. That made my daddy so happy that he bought us all double-dip ice cream cones. Mother got word that Uncle Shep was low. I didn't know what she meant, low. Mother had 7 old uncles over in Howard County, and they were all as big as Goliath. They were not low. They were at least 6 feet tall, had big hands, big hair, and big teeth. Mother said low meant Uncle Shep might die. He had tuberculosis. So she decided we must visit him. Mother's visiting don'ts included, don't run in the house and do not shout. Use your inside voice and best yes ma'am and no ma'am manners. And above all, don't prowl in that old house. Since my brother and I both had colds, Mom even had sneeze do's and don'ts. Use your handkerchief, cover your nose. Don't wipe your nose on your sleeve. Then she pointed to me and said, you don't wipe your nose on your brother's shirt collar. If I were Wonder Woman, I would use my magic lasso and make him tell why he told Mother on me. We didn't used to tell on each other, but how else would she know? My brother and I did not tattle because we needed each other. Uncle Shep and Aunt Luella's old house fascinated me. The living room had big windows that sparkled, 2 hard, straight back chairs with cane bottoms, 1 rocking chair made of cedar, and dollies on the furniture. There was some kind of sofa that looked like an injured dragon that could not fly. And on top of all that, it smelled like something, I don't know what. The old house gave me the creeps. It seemed like a den of sorrow or something out of a fairy tale. The nerves of the house were really bad because when I walked across the wood floors, they would squeak. And sitting down in a straight chair made the chair moan. I have never seen a house before with such bad nerves. There was one picture above the mantel. It had no color, and it showed some poor lady with her head wrapped up, and she had on an apron, and the sign under the picture said the gleaner. I didn't know what a gleaner was, but it sure did not make her happy. There was, however, a pretty little maroon-colored velvet box on the mantel. It was intriguing and inviting. I did remember the don't about prowling in their house, and I knew I might get in trouble with my mother if I looked inside the box, but it was worth it. It was a chance I had to take. I had to look in that box. It just seemed to call me. I went with my mother to the back room to see Uncle Shep. Something had got a hold of him. He was skinny as a drawing of a stick man. His teeth looked like broken icicles. His hair resembled a tumbleweed, and there was a hole in the right side of his face. Aunt Leela didn't look much better. She was not one of the big people. She wasn't much taller than me, and she wore her hair in curls, held back by 2 turquoise combs, and she always wore store-bought clothes, which are always starched and ironed. And she wore pretty shoes. I wanted to be just like her. I wanted to talk like her. I practiced saying, I do declare, Martha Maud, those pear preserves are not as good as the jar that won first place at the county fair. Martha Maud would respond appropriately, even if she didn't mean a word of it. But Aunt Lou didn't look so swell anymore. She was skinny, and her clothes were dowdy. I started to tell Mother that I thought Aunt Lou had waited too long to stay young, but I decided against it, because Mother didn't act like she would appreciate that observation at this time. Everybody was talking quietly behind their hands. Since I had brains, I decided that now would be a good time to go out the side door, around the house, come in the front hall, into the living room, which I did. But I could not reach the mantel where the box was, so I went into the dining room and got a little 3-legged stool. I pulled the stool to the mantel and got the box in both my hands and opened the box. The content of the box scared me so that I fell backward from the stool and the content clattered across the hearth. Believe it or not, the contents of that box looked at me, spoke to me, and that's when I thought I'd wet my pants. My smart brain failed me. I didn't know what to do. I dare not tell my sister or brother. They would tell Mother. Finally, I realized I had to put the thing back in the box. So I closed my eyes, picked up that cold, hard, slick thing, and put it in the velvet box and placed it back on the mantel. Believe it or not, that box wasn't nearly as attractive as it was before. I could not remember exactly where the box had been on the mantle, but I didn't care. I had to get out of that living room pronto. If we were sick, tired, or scared, Mother would not scold us for not obeying the don'ts. Mother had patience. I just literally flew back to the sick room and got as close to my mother as possible. I got right under her left arm. She thought that was unusual, as it was not my nature to sit quietly. She thought I might be sick. She kept placing her hand on my forehead to see if I had fever, and she asked me several times if I were sick. I just wanted to be with my mama. I did not even want to go with the other children to hold the baby chickens and pet the little goats. I was wounded. I was repentant. I wanted to smell the talcum powder that Mama always wore. I wanted to hear her heartbeat, to feel her gentle touch, to see her smile at me. I wanted to hear the do's and don'ts again. The rest of the day, I stayed close to Mama, practically under her arm. Curiosity might not have killed the cat, but Uncle Shep's glass eye frightened me into behaving.
Catherine King was born in Clark County, Arkansas, the middle child of three children. She married B.J. King 57 years ago. They have two children and seven grandchildren. Her favorite pastimes are reading and Southern cooking. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers' Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, iTunes, Twitter, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.
crazy, take a turn. Let them whisper and point their finger. Let that grapevine spread the word. They'll be lining up for miles for the greatest show on earth. Hey, shoot me to that big top. I'm a real life cannonball. If it wasn't for a freak show, there wouldn't be no show.